there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 307. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, stroll on over to the Facebook. Type in thisshowisogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. I am so excited for this week's show, and thus I must get started with our guest. Jay Mace III is a black trans queer poet based in my old stomping grounds of New York City. He is a blogger for the Huffington Post. He is the author of If I Should Die Under the Knife, Tell My Kidney I Was the Fiercest Poet Around, as well as the work And Then I Got Fire, One Trans Queer's Reflections on Grief, Unemployment, and Inappropriate Jokes About Death. As an educator, Jay Mace has worked with thousands of community members in the U.S. and England and Canada on the needs of the LGBTQIA youth and adults in spaces such as K-12 schools, colleges and universities, faith communities, and restricted care facilities, among many others. He is the founder of an international performance tour, Cupid Ain't, and then I can't say that word, it's an expletive, an anti-Valentine's Day poetry movement, and he is the founder of Awkward, the first ever trans and queer people of color specific talent agency. So excited to welcome him, Jay Mace III. Welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have so much ground to cover. Are you even remotely ready?
I'm a little ready. I'm gonna try to keep up with what you got putting down.
All right, let's see. I don't even know what I'm gonna put down yet, but let's start out. Now, you are only in 307 episodes. You are only our second ever poet. No pressure.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
I know. Talk to our listening audience. Why the medium of poetry to get your voice out there?
So when I think about specifically poetry and spoken word performance poetry realm, it's really about the idea of controlling our narratives, right? So that oftentimes when we look at what does it even mean to be, you know, queer or trans in 2015, often the story that's given to us is one that's very cisgender, is very white, is very middle class, upper class, English speaking only, you know. And to me, poetry is a way that we get to not just tell people who we are, but also to become comfortable in telling and claiming our own stories. And so for me, in that way, poetry has always been the venue and vehicle through which I've chosen to share my analysis and my work.
Now, if I go out there looking, and I might, if I go out there looking for the earliest Jay Mace III poem, what would I find?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the first poem I ever wrote, I was about 8 years old.
Love it.
So you might not find that poem, but that was that was an interesting experience. And so I've been performing since I was about, I would say, on some professional stages by the time I was 19, so for about the last 11 years.
Yeah.
You might find a mixed bag of stuff. You might find a mixed bag.
Let me be very upfront with you. I want to get my hands on that 8-year-old poem.
I was on a panel, I think, a few months ago, and someone was like, yeah, I started writing poems when I was 8, and she actually had it written down. And her piece, it was like going into race dynamics, it was going into like queerness, it was going into gender dynamics, and all this stuff, and I was like, gag, I was trying to, you know, not poop on myself and learn to tie my shoes, but my piece was brilliant. My piece was not as brilliant, but I appreciate that.
And with that, I'm not as excited to go find that poem. So exciting. Now, you are not only a poet, but you're a teaching poet. What does that mean to you?
For me, it means that, and so I think even going back to your initial question of what does it mean to use poetry as a medium,
When
I think about social justice movements, I think of them on three major fronts. This is very corny, but I've used this mantra since I was about 18, but I believe it sort of happens on the levels of head, heart, and feet. And so feet where we do sort of physical, actual organizing in activist communities. Heart, where we're impacted artistically and spiritually to actually move to certain directions. And through the head, through intellectual development. And so being able to do education work as not just teaching poetry and performance, but also other education pieces. I do a lot of work on liberation theology. I do a lot of work on talking about what is the basic experience of being trans and queer. I do a lot of work on, you know, just a range of different, and what is the racial analysis of all those things in an intersectional world, you know? So it's about being able to bring that sort of complex conversation to people in a way that they can also use it artistically and in their actual movements.
We have so much to talk about. I barely know which direction to go. Let me just put out there, listening audience, this is going to be interview number one of eight with J. Mace III. So much to discuss. So much to discuss. Now, I will say that all fierce poets are poets, but not all poets are fierce. Is that correct?
You know, I think that to me, so where I'll dangle this line a little bit, I think everyone can be a poet, and I think that given the right tools, everyone can speak truth. And so I think sometimes we're not all given the tools that we need to speak truth. We're often given tools to look cool, or we're given tools to rhyme well, or we're given tools to stand on stage and seem like we know what we're doing and not necessarily to be honest with ourselves, because that takes certain vulnerability. So my pushback would be, I think everyone has the capacity to be fierce.
See, it was the capacity. So how do we get there? I mean, you know, I'm sure there are any number of listeners who are just thinking to themselves, I want to put myself out there more authentically, but it's a scary place to put yourself out there like that.
I think you have to be disappointed a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that, to me, a vulnerability in my art and sort of being able to be in a place in which I felt like I could be honest with people also had to be at a place where, you know, I've been an awkward person most of my life, and I had to get to a place where I wasn't worried about looking cool anymore. I wasn't worried about impressing people. I just had some stuff on my spirit I had to get out.
Yeah.
And so I think that that honesty, as well as being able to say, this work actually isn't about me. So as an artist, when I'm stepping on stage, I'm not sharing something just for myself, but also because I know that there are other people that might need to hear it. And so how do I get to a place in which I'm not just channeling my own ego, but I'm channeling something that is hopefully has the capacity to ease some hearts, as well as to empower people to think differently about the world around them, because you have that 3 minutes to kind of shift a lot of narratives.
Yeah. What's your process like? Are you very regimented? Do things just come to you? Do you have I'm sensing with the laughter, maybe not so much. Is there a place that you like to write? What's your process like?
My process is being up at 3:30 in the morning. I think there's this drunk sleep time, you know, where you don't need to be consuming any substances. It's just that you're so tired, your brain starts making new connections. And for me, that time is around 3:30, 4:30 in the morning.
Wait, are you serious? That can't possibly be true.
Listen, I'm telling you, that's when I write the best. I'm telling you, there's something about being up that late. Your brain, because you're just, you're much more creative. You know, I think when we're awake, again, we're so restricted by the ways that other people are judging us, by the ways other things are other people are sort of constructing our space. There's something about that time in which your mind is sort of shutting down, and you're sort of also in a dreamlike state, and so it's a lot easier for you to actually think in new ways versus like, oh, point A to point B, straight line. It doesn't have to be that way. It could be a circle. It could be like a star. It could be, you know, a piece of sand. It could be whatever you want it to be.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think that I've seen 3:30 since The Tunnel, 1998. I really... We're going to have to go back some New York City years for me to see that. I can't even wrap my mind around it. And then, are you very critical of your own work, or can you put something out there and feel like, you know what, that's what I want it to be?
Usually for me, I'm writing a piece for about 3 months. So I get a piece will come to me, and I'll have a framework of it that I'll share with people. I'll share on stage with a few times, and I'll obsess over for the first week. So I'll read it to myself every day, for maybe 10 times a day. For the first week, I'll get to a place where I feel comfortable sharing it on stage a little bit. And even while I'm processing it on stage for the first few months, I'm still rewriting it. So, for example, you know, there's a piece I wrote maybe 2 months ago. It's partway done. Maybe I'll get done it in the next month. Maybe I'll get done it in next year. But it's always shifting based on my experiences with it on stage and how it also feels in my body and how true it feels in that moment and how it sort of needs to hit people.
You know I'm still on the 3:30 in the morning piece, right? Like, I'm going to move on to other topics, but I'm going to be stuck there.
There's actually a TED Talk on 4 a.m. and just like the mystery of this 4 a.m. and how, again, that creative power stuff. So I just like to put out, I'm not the only one up late at night, you know, making all these connections. There's something about that time. And so I think even you know, when you think about some of the most creative minds, I think a lot of people actually don't have regular sleep cycles. You know, they're doing different things. They're like maybe sleeping two hours, getting up, sleeping another 2 hours. You know, there's something about that creative energy that's put out at nighttime or even in dawn for some people, in dusk. That's what allows them to be more hazy. So
I was,
try it out.
I was so excited for our friendship. And it's just, I don't know. I don't know. I feel like we're up at different hours. So we'll talk about that. Now, you were one of several facilitators for the Racial Justice Institute at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force's Creating Change Conference. I mean, it just seems so ridiculous to ask you, hey, how'd that go? But what do you feel like you accomplished? Let's start there.
So what I'll share is that for me, the Racial Justice Institute was one moment in which I got to do some of that work. And a lot of the work that I do is about racial justice because it's not possible for me to separate what it means for me to have my rights as a trans or queer person from my blackness, you know? And so for me, what I think is a big disadvantage of a lot of queer spaces is there's this sort of myth of a cohesive LGBTQ community, which erases class and erases race and erases gender and all these complexities that exist in. And so for me, anytime I think when we're actually able to be clear and direct about the disparities that exist around race and across race in the LGBTQ community, we're actually closer to getting what it means to have queer rights, you know, because we can't really actually talk about getting rid of LGBTQ youth homelessness without talking about race.
Right.
We can't talk about getting rid of HIV and AIDS in the ways that it's and people not actually getting access to care if we don't talk about race or class or talking about access to jobs, like especially around trans people and people of color in that work. And so I think it's just about being more honest, right?
Yeah. You know, but it's a crazy little paradox, isn't it? Because look, I'm a college professor. I teach race. This is what I do. That's what they pay me to do. And I feel like there are any number of instances where I feel like I've had an easier time starting a conversation with my white students than I have with my LGBT peers, which on the very surface just seems so ridiculous to me. We're talking about, you know, which voices are at the table. And yet when we're talking about multiple identities, it's like so disabling to so many folks in the LGBT community to have that conversation, which is slightly awe-inspiring on some levels.
I think it's, to me, I actually feel like it's right on point with some of the values that we're taught to buy into, right? So I look at organizations across the board that say words like equality, let's fight for equality. To me, the question is, well, who are we being equal to, right? So are we talking about a cisgender white Wall Street banker? And am I, like, as a trans person of color, am I trying to be equal to that person? Or am I trying to get to what the needs are of 15-year-old black trans woman in, North Philadelphia, right? So they have very different trajectories in that way. And so I think there's a piece of a lot of mainstream LGBTQ space that, again, teaches us, you know, just everyone, you know, just smile together, be together, blend in, and somehow all these things are going to come into fruition. And that's not actually what's being talked about. So it's actually impossible. We're actually taught to ignore all those things about our identities.
We had our great buddy Kenyon Farrow on the show a few months ago, and we talked a little bit about creating change and certainly some of the dialogue that some folks tried to get started, but also a lot of the barriers. And this is where we have to take a second and be critical and certainly be supportive of our national LGBT organizations, but we have to be critical of which voices they're raising up, right?
Right, most definitely.
What were you able to see there? What work still needs to be done from those leaders?
I mean, so just as we saw the protests by Bambi Sausalito and a bunch of other folks kind of coming, especially run by trans folks of color, sort of storming stage and saying like, hey, this is stuff that y'all need to pay attention to. So I think that what must happen is we need to look at our organizations and ask, why do you not have trans people of color in leadership?
Yeah.
Why specifically do you not have trans women of color in leadership? Why do you not have people with disabilities in leadership? Why do you not have poor people in leadership, right, or people that grew up poor in leadership? Because I think the consistent story that I often hear from mainstream LGBTQ organizations, I've worked for national LGBTQ organizations as well as more local organizations, and everyone can always tell me who is most at risk for anti-LGBTQ violence. Everybody knows that story. Everybody knows who's most at risk for joblessness, who's most at risk for homelessness. And yet, they're not hiring these people, but they're writing grants with these statistics about all this violence, about all this stuff, and making money off of the disenfranchisement of many people of color and many trans folks and many folks with disabilities that are completely axed out of their services.
Yeah.
And so we must hold people accountable to say it's not okay for you to make money off my body or the bodies of my friends who aren't even welcome to be on your board of directors, who are not welcome to be on your payroll, who are not welcome to be full-time on your payroll and often asked to do free services.
Right. Let me push you to the next step, because I feel like we're at that point, because we have a ton of executive directors of LGBT statewide organizations on the show, and all of them articulate. I mean, there's not an interview that happens on the show where I don't ask it or they don't freely articulate, yes, we need more representation in our leadership and on our board. And yet that awareness doesn't culminate in it actually happening.
Right. Because they have to give up power.
Yeah, there you go.
Right? So everybody else is always racist. Everybody else is always transphobic. Everybody else is always ableist, is always classist. It's never actually coming down to, crap, I'm taking up space. How do I not do that, right?
Right.
If everyone thinks that their voice is so important that they have to be the one that's heard, and that's not true, especially if you're taking up the space that could be taken by more marginalized voices.
Yeah. It's like, yes, our board says that we can only have 15 people on it. So who would we have to kick off? No, why don't you look at your bylaws? It's easy to increase that to 16 or 17 or however many you want to add. Oh my gosh, there's so much work to do. All right. Talk to me about organ donation, because that's a part of your life.
So when I was, about six years ago, a friend of mine who used to be someone I worked with had kidney failure. And so we ended up having an organ donation surgery, I think like the week after my 25th birthday, something like that. And for me, when I think about, I think for a lot of people, it seems like a very like foreign idea of like, oh, people give up their organs and people do this stuff. And oftentimes, a lot of people that don't even know each other participate in organ donation surgeries, because I think especially for those of us that are healthy, and especially if you have access to certain types of healthcare and other sort of things, it was actually a very easy process for me.
I love it. And my gosh, could there ever be a better title of a book ever?
I was actually, and what that was really about was, I remember my mother often asking my family members, were like, what are you doing? What do you mean you're giving up your kidney? What are you doing? I can't even believe you're doing this. And I was, my mother was asking me, oh, do you want me to come with you to the hospital? Do you need like a buddy? Do you need something? And I kept telling her, no, I don't need anything. I'm fine. I'm good. You're just overreacting. And then I remember I got to the hospital and Law and Order was on the TV as I'm unrolling.
No.
And of course, Law and Order, everything is always wrong. So
yeah, there's no way. Yeah. There's no way this story's working out at all.
Yeah. So I'm like thinking, I'm going to die. I'm going to die here. And I haven't told anybody what time surgery is or anything like that. And I wake up is after the operation, and my mother is holding my hand. I was like, oh, my goodness. I'm so glad you're here. I'm so glad, that again, even though everything worked out very fine for me, there was that moment of uncertainty for the couple hours beforehand.
Well, again, listeners, we are here with J. Mace III, an incredible, incredible, fierce poet. Now, you have a couple pieces on the Huffington Post, and in one of them you write this, quote, as a black trans artist, I crave to live an authentic life that validates all my identities. On this journey, I will be interviewing a handful of black trans thought leaders I have been blessed to share space with. And folks can stroll on over, and we'll provide the link. You indeed did interview a few black trans thought leaders. What was that experience like for you?
So for me, what's really great is that, so again, even back to the questions of, at the Racial Justice Institute, at Creating Change in other spaces, what do I or what did I hope to accomplish in those spaces? And the reality is that I think there's a certain amount of analysis that's happening already in trans people of color spaces that isn't necessarily happening in places or in communities that tend to erase or imagine themselves outside of that intersectionality, right? And so for me, what's been nice is sort of been bringing those conversations. I'm still going to be actually adding some more people in the next month or so to that series and to another few HuffPost pieces. But that I get to bring that fullness and that richness and that, and let people know that the ideas that I have, when people tell me, oh, Jay Mace, you have all these like really fabulous ideas, it's like, yeah, you know, I'd like to believe I'm smart, and I come from a really amazing community that has helped me build this.
Yeah.
All the insight that I have is not mine. I created like with the help of my ancestors, with the help of my elders, with the help of my community members right now in communities doing work that is intersectional, that is about class, that is about gender, that is about race, and about all those things all the time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Such great stuff. Such great stuff. Now, we have to talk about Awkward, a talent agency, a compendium, a collective of incredible voices. Where did this come from?
It came from a lot of racist, homophobic stuff I would get from venues, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So as someone who's a full-time artist, a lot of times when I would reach out to venues and say, hey, I'm a poet, I'm black, I'm trans, I'm this, da-da-da, you know, this is my work, blah, 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 I would get stuff back like, oh, you're black? Well, Black History Month is over. Oh, you're trans? Well, we had a trans person come speak 2 months ago, so we don't exactly need you. And so when you're talking about paying your bills in a system that believes that you're a flavor of the month in that way, we sort of just only get to exist at a trans day of remembrance, or only get to exist during Black History Month, or only get to exist during LGBTQ History Week or month, you know, it sort of sets you up for failure. And so I kind of got to a place in which I found a formula that allowed me to pay my bills in a way that was effective and allowed me to kind of create a lucrative niche for myself. And I kept having conversations with other trans and queer folks of color artists and speakers in my life and saying, well, what's your experience? And they were having some of the same issues.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were struggling more than I was because there wasn't, you know, I think at that point I had some mentors in my life or people in my life that helped push me in a certain direction that even though formulas change, especially with social media and especially with the way that YouTube is now and all this, then maybe when they first started as full-time artists, but I had some people helping me out a little bit. So I started having one-on-ones with friends, and I got to a place of thinking, you know, maybe we should think about what this looks like to formalize a lot of these relationships. So, because sometimes it, unfortunately, because as people of color, as trans folks, as queer folks of color, that it became clear that some people would take you more seriously if you're part of an agency.
Yeah.
And so in many ways, it's about advocating for each other. It's about saying, you know, we as artists and educators are actually documenting the actual history of our people right now. And we have a right as documenters of that history, documenters of this culture, to be able to survive.
Yeah.
You know, because that's really what we're trying to accomplish with it.
I love it. I love it. Well, look, I like the part where you make money. I'm a big fan of that. So I'm going to let you control this next part. We have any number of college folks listening, you know, all my peers who work in student activities,
yeah,
and folks everywhere who are looking to book talent. What are they going to get when they book you for an event?
So again, that's when we talk about shifting and actually attacking the things that create anti-LGBTQ violence, anti-LGBTQ homelessness, joblessness, all these different things, you get to be part of a movement that prioritizes trans people of color. So you do not only get to laugh your butt off with people, with comedians, or have really brilliant poets, or have really brilliant educators, have faith workers and other people that come from all these different vantage points, you get to actually think critically about where you spend your money, because it's not enough that we think theoretically about these issues, but we must also think about where do we put our actual funding dollars,
right?
Because that type of financial solidarity also keeps people alive.
Yeah.
So it's great when we talk about, oh, it's, you know, we want to think intersectionally about, you know, we really appreciate you coming out and talking about this stuff, but did you make sure that person got to eat that night?
Right.
Did you make sure that person wasn't on the street? Did you make sure? And that's what we provide, is a place in which we have currently an all trans people of color led administrative team, which is very intentional. And will continue to be at least majority trans people of color as we expand. But that as we, even the queer cis folks on our roster, there's also an understanding of why trans people are often prioritized in the space. And these are also some really, for everyone on our roster, are just some really brilliant thought leaders that I think are making some amazing changes just globally,
yeah.
from people like Dreamwolf, who do work in Sri Lanka as well as in the U.S., for people like Reggie Kabiko, who does youth work in D.C., New York, and Philly, for people, you know, like Lourdes Ashley-Hunter, who just came back from Geneva doing work with the U.N. I think we have some of the top-tier creators of this intellectual movement right now sort of being a part of our team, which is really exciting.
I'm going to be very upfront with you, and this is not something I would normally say, but, you know, this is part of what it is I do during my day job of teaching this. I have this little part of me that's nagging me that I get nervous about. Like, I want you guys to get booked left, right, up, and down. I'm telling you, all my college friends, book everybody on this talent list. I also, though, there's a part of me that gets a little bit nervous how they're going to create advertisements, you know, that they're mm-hmm. going to advertise your talent in ways that aren't fetishizing and aren't tokenizing. And I would, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't highlight that's a concern of mine, that because talent like yours, the talent that you've put together and these amazing voices are not as present as they should be, I get nervous that some of my colleagues at colleges and universities won't appropriately know how to market you all. Is that a fair concern?
That could be a fair concern. And what I'll say is that we're also really good at knowing and talking to people through, like, what does it mean to market us or talk about us?
Nice.
Right. So I think that's for me, and not just around race and class and gender pieces, but also just as an artist, you know, I always want to be, we always want to be represented appropriately.
Yeah.
And so those are always conversations about this, the language that we use. These are the images that we appreciate. And these are the ways that you talk about what we do, because we know how to talk about it. Because, again, we've been having these conversations all the time. And so we want to, you know, welcome folks into this kind of framework. Right, this very important framework, which again is recentering this type of specific information base.
Oh, it's so important. Hey, we have to touch briefly on, you know, things that folks might feel about Valentine's Day.
That's actually how I really started my career, I'll say, as being sort of getting to a place in which I could sustain myself, was doing all these Cupid ain't bleeps anti-Valentine's Day poetry movements. It's actually something, so I started this when I, about, I think, 7.5 years ago, something like that. And it was just in a little place in the Bubble House in Philly, which is no longer operating, which is really sad, because the first one, it was myself and like 6 other poets. We did 2 nights, and it was 50 people all shoved into this room watching us perform. You could only have like maybe 6 inches in front of you to move before you hit an audience member, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So you had to think very critically about your movements. But for me, I like to tell people I have a lot of bitter old love stories. And, you know, whereas other people have just broken up with people or something didn't work out or a crush was unrequited and all that kind of stuff, you know, I actually have built my career off of it. So it's okay. Like, there is a life after breakups, you know?
That makes me feel better.
It's a lot of life. And I always joke with my partner now, like, you don't, because he's always like, oh, you don't write any poems about me. And I was telling him, like, you don't actually want to be a writer. Never actually goes well. So it's good that there's no poems about you yet.
That's hilarious. That is funny right there. Now, I do know that you are quite the Philadelphia devotee, but I would imagine that New York City is quite conducive to your craft and ever inspiring.
What I'll say, so Philly allowed me to become an artist that felt comfortable about becoming professionalized, right? And again, that space in which I, as someone who's creating this art and as someone who's, you know, in this space, Philly is a really beautiful city to become a professional artist in. It's very supportive. People will come out to your stuff. It's also very cheap to rent out venues. I love Philly so much for that. And the art scene is so amazing. What I'll say about New York is that there's a bigger art scene and it's a little bit more tough to navigate. And so, whereas New York has enough connections that I felt comfortable starting an organization, Philly is what gave me the foundation to be able to do any of that.
Nice.
I don't know if I would have been able to do Awkward if I didn't start out in Philly.
I love it. All right, listen. I know it's not 3:30 in the morning, so I know this isn't your most creative time, but I have to put you on the spot, as I put our last poet on the spot years ago when Kit Yan was on the show.
I love Kit.
I love Kit. What would the first line of the poem about our little gay radio show be? What would the I only need the first line. That's all I need.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Deep breath. I know it. Just pretend it's 3:30 in the morning.
We spoke at length about freedom.
Look at that. Oh my God, I'm putting that on the website like right now. There's nothing left to talk about. What is coming up for you? I know, it's great. What is coming up for you that you are excited about?
So for me, really, I think Awkward's taking over my life in a good way, which has been nice. For me, now that it's the school, a lot of my time during the school year is doing administrative work for Awkward as well as doing being a touring poet, right?
Yeah.
So the last thing I just got done was the Let Us Breathe Forum. I got to speak on the Let Us Breathe Forum in New York Saturday. That was pretty amazing.
Nice.
What's coming next is, aside from sending out a whole bunch of fun emails and social media messages about what Awkward does and all that kind of stuff, as an individual, I'll be doing a lot of like work with faith communities this summer, as well as doing some different LGBTQ youth camps. I'll be at Camp Pride this summer, so for anyone who's listening, I'll be there. I'll also be, at Capturing Fire, which is in June and run by one of our one of the folks on our poets on our roster, Reggie Kabiko. Capturing Fire is a international queer poetry festival. It happens the weekend of June 5th. It's also the same week as Trans Health Conference. So I'll also be curating a show at the Trans Health Conference with the Leeway Foundation. It's called the Leeway Trans Literary Night on Thursday of the Trans Health Conference. So I'll be there as well. And hopping around, aside from D.C. and Philly, I'll be hopping around to the magical land of Ann Arbor, Michigan this summer, and to Detroit for the Allied Media Conference and a few other places around the country.
You cannot wake up at 3:30 in the morning if you have all these things to do.
Sometimes I don't sleep, Ken.
I don't like it. I don't like it. All right, listeners, here are all the sites you need to go to. You must, of course, stroll on over to jmaceiii.com, and you will learn all about J. Mace III, the rowdiest trans queer poet you know. And there are amazing videos on there. And I know, I'm sure this is oft quoted to you, but Josephine is amazing. And if folks have not seen your YouTube video of Josephine, incredible, incredible stuff. And everybody must stroll on over to Awkward Talent. That's awkwardtalent.com. And you're going to see an incredible roster there. I don't often say this about a guest. You have to know I'm a little bit obsessed with you. little bit.
Oh, that makes me feel, I'm obsessed with you now.
Look
we're
at
obsessed
that.
With each other.
Look at
now
that.
We made new friends. We're so excited.
This is why we do this. No, I really, anybody who is putting their voice out there as authentically as you are and standing up and saying, you know what, there is power to be challenged and we do have to call things out in the way that they actually are, and I'm also going to do it using my craft. It is such a beautiful thing to watch you using your voice like that, and I urge you to keep on doing it.
Thank you.
J. Mace III, what an absolute treat having you on the show.
Thank you for having me, and hopefully this is one of eight, so hopefully we'll get to do this again at some point. I'm definitely down whenever you call.
You got it.
I'm in the dark, I like to read his mind. But I'm frightened of the things I might find. Oh, there must be something he's thinking of to tear him away. Can I tell him that I'm falling in love? Why is he sad?
Right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have oodles of time left on this week's show to cover all the latest LGBT news happening out there. We turn our attention first to the great state of Arkansas. Residents of Eureka Springs, Arkansas, voted this week overwhelmingly to retain the town's LGBT rights ordinance, even though a state law will render it unenforceable. in this small tourist town, which is known as, and there's a ton of articles about this, they call this town the gay capital of the Ozarks. The vote count was 579 for keeping the ordinance and 231 against. The result was markedly different from that in another Arkansas town, Fayetteville, where voters last year repealed an LGBT-inclusive civil rights law. And in Springfield, which is in neighboring Missouri, which saw a voter repeal of such a law in April. And this is a quote from Lamont Ritchie, who is a justice of the peace who authored the ordinance. He told a celebrating crowd this week, quote, "What is really special about tonight is that we are all legal. We are the only community in Arkansas that legitimizes a broad range of people." The Eureka Springs City Council, they had adopted this ordinance, and we covered this back in February, shortly before the state legislature passed a bill that bars any municipality from enacting or enforcing a civil rights law that is broader than state law, which state law in Arkansas does not cover sexual orientation or gender identity. That state measure will go into effect on July 20th. So many different points of the story. First, again, a reminder that our legislators in various states, this is what they're spending their time on. They are passing bills barring municipalities from enacting or enforcing civil rights laws that are broader than the state law. So they are saying, look, we know that you want to go out of your way to protect certain members of your citizenry. We would like to remind you that we would not like you to do that. Please do not go above and beyond protections that we already offer, which is so unbelievably ridiculous. But this is a great example, and I'm thrilled to start with this story, a great example with the residents of Eureka Springs, Arkansas, saying, look, we know that in a month and a half, everything that we do right this second is going to be unenforceable. But at the same time, we're still going to raise up our voices. We're still going to say to our state legislators, what you're doing is a mistake. What you're doing does not stand for this community. And so whereas other people are saying, what a futile gesture. Why are they spending their time doing that? No, it's a great thing. It's a great thing to raise up your voice, because otherwise you just are kind of acquiescing in a way that's really uncomfortable for all the residents who don't believe in what the state legislatures are doing. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Mayor Robert Butch Berry, he told a local newspaper, quote, "Ours will become basically ineffective at that point." He's talking about in July when the state goes into effect, but it still was important for them to do. So important for them to do. Local conservative Christians denounced the ordinance, and the city council agreed to put it to popular vote. The council wrote the ballot question itself so as to be able to control the wording. Now that voters have upheld the ordinance, some right-wing Christians are still angry, claiming opponents of the law were discouraged from voting. One of the most outspoken is Randall Christie, who runs the Great Passion Play, which is a reenactment of Jesus Christ's last days staged in the summer at an amphitheater near Eureka Springs. And this is what he said, quote, "I don't think people understand the kind of people we're dealing with in Eureka Springs. There is an infill of very vile, radical, vicious people in this town. They've gone around intimidating people to the point that they were afraid to get out of their homes today. The Bible-believing Christians did not have the guts to get out and vote." Yeah, and everybody else says, that's not really how it happened, sir. That's not how it happened at all. And also, by the way, sir, in a couple of weeks, like 6 weeks, it's really not going to matter anymore because your state ordinance trumps everything that Eureka Springs did, even though, again, a reminder, you should raise up your voice. So there's that. Elton John in the news this week. Elton John, I mean, do I have to clarify? Best known for his award-winning pop songs and anthems, he used his voice this week to urge the United States Senate to fund AIDS and HIV research and treatment at levels that will end a crisis more than three decades old. Elton John said this, quote, "This Congress indeed has the power to end AIDS. There is a window of opportunity before us, a window through which we can very clearly see the end of AIDS within my lifetime. We cannot afford to let that window close," end quote. Elton John talked about his AIDS Foundation efforts, which has raised so many millions of dollars, and he pushed Congress to continue its own funding towards combating the disease until it is completely eradicated. He said, quote, "This is the most powerful legislative body in the world. Thanks to the unprecedented actions of Congress, an HIV-positive mother in South Africa can give birth to a healthy HIV free baby who she can live to raise. Thanks to the generosity of the American people, 9.4 million men, women, and children have access to life-saving antiretroviral treatment. But he did say this. Elton John warned that if efforts are rolled back because of funding cuts or diverted attention, then the disease could, quote, once again become a ruthless pandemic with disastrous and far-reaching consequences. There you go, Elton John. He explained to senators how he had transformed himself from a hit musician to one of the world's leading AIDS activists. He said, quote, "You have to remember I'm British and I came over here in 1970. This country gave me everything as a professional musician and it's given me everything to me as a human being. And the strength and the willingness to help people in the rest of the world has touched me so much." Elton John. Elton John lending his voice, using his voice in a different way to create change. Love that. Love that. More people doing good things in the great state of Oregon. Oregon will soon join California, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. in banning the use of ex-gay therapy on minors. Yay! A bill barring state-licensed professionals from subjecting minors to the discredited and harmful practice passed the Oregon Senate this week by a vote of 21-3, with one member who didn't show up. We're not going to call him out, though. The House had passed the legislation earlier in March, and it now goes to Governor Kate Brown, who is expected to sign it into law. The practice, also known as conversion therapy, is designed to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity, but it has been denounced by all major mental health groups in the nation, as well as President Obama and other top federal officials. Oregon State Senator Sarah Gelser, a backer of the bill, said this, quote, "Conversion therapy at its core, I believe, is an act of violence. Being lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender is not a mental disorder, and it is not something that should be cured." Basic Rights Oregon, the Human Rights Campaign, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights all worked for passage of the bill. So a nice group effort there. I will just say this, you know, I'm reading a lot of this week's stories from The Advocate. I pulled a lot of my news from The Advocate this week. And in this particular story, let me read the sentence as it was written. Here's what I said and what I said earlier. The House had passed the legislation earlier in March, and it now goes to Governor Kate Brown, who is expected to sign into law. What the article actually says is the House had passed the legislation earlier in March, and it now goes to openly bisexual Governor Kate Brown, who is expected to sign it into law. So let me go a little bit meta here and veer away from the Oregon story, which, yay, by the way, yay for Oregon joining only two states and Washington, D.C., California, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C., to ban ex-gay therapy for minors. It's doing so much damage. So I don't want to lose the focus there that this is a great thing. This is a great thing. But why? Why did we have to say, and it now goes to openly bisexual Governor Kate Brown? Why are we labeling? In this particular story, that has absolutely no relevance. It doesn't have any relevance whatsoever that Governor Kate Brown is openly bisexual. In fact, in some ways, it does the exact opposite. It highlights, well, she'll probably sign it because she's openly bisexual. I think there are any number of stories. If you had Governor Kate Brown leads a march for marriage equality, I think it should maybe come up there. You know, it's related in that way. But in this story, I just don't get it. Not in this way. Not in this way. So I'm reading through the comment section and no one else has highlighted that. And I feel like they should because it's not relevant here. It's not relevant here. So there's that. We're going to turn our attention to some other countries that it's not really going as well. Not going as well as our three happy stories that we're starting out with. In Kenya, a Nairobi-based newspaper is under fire for publishing a list of Kenya's top gays and lesbians in a move that is eerily reminiscent of the media practices in neighboring Uganda that we've covered so much before that all observers believe have prompted homophobic attacks and murders. Kenya's Weekly Citizen, which bills itself as, quote, Kenya's most authoritative political newspaper, that's intimidating. Just at the end of last week, they published a front-page story featuring photos of what the paper describes as, quote, top gays, lesbians list in Kenya. George Barasa, a Kenyan gay rights activist, told Uganda's Kuchu Times, a news outlet run by LGBT activists in East Africa, he said this, quote, "The article was clearly written to instigate violence towards the LGBT community and activists in particular, but that won't stop us from fighting for our rights. We shall not be cowed or intimidated." Love that quote. Newspapers in East Africa are no stranger to splashing the names and photos of leading LGBT activists, along with provocative headlines across the publication Nation's front page. In 2011, and we covered this way back when, 4 years ago, a now defunct Ugandan tabloid ran a similar article listing the country's, quote, top homos, remember that? Including prominent activist David Kato under a text banner that read, "Hang them." Shortly after Kato's picture appeared on the tabloid's front page, he was bludgeoned to death with a hammer inside his own home. Oh my gosh. It's so different. In some other countries, it's so different. A judge ultimately rejected a gay panic defense from his killer and sentenced the attacker to 30 years in prison. So this is some of the climate going on in some other places. And it gets even worse. Get this one. You ready? Take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. Gambia. In Gambia, their infamously homophobic dictator, President Yahya Gamet, he has threatened, this is what he did, this is their president of Gambia, he has threatened to personally slit the throats of any man who wants to marry another man in Gambia. Ironically, the personal threat made against his gay countrymen in a public speech was supposed to be about, quote, fostering a healthy atmosphere for Gambia's youth. Yeah, that's not exactly what came out. This is what he said, quote, "If you do it in Gambia, I will slit your throat. If you are a man and want to marry another man in this country and we catch you, no one will ever set eyes on you again, and no white person can do anything about it," end quote. His reference to, quote, "no white person" is likely a jab at Western diplomats and governments, according to his former press secretary, Fatou Camara. Camara now works as a journalist after fleeing the country to escape sedition charges. But the president is not the only, lest you think that the president of Gambia is the only one saying things like this. He is not the only official there in Gambia proudly showing his homophobic tendencies. His foreign minister recently told a European Union gathering that her boss would follow international law, but that the government would, quote, "protect religious beliefs and traditions." If you read in between the lines, this is according to the former press secretary, if you read in between the lines, the foreign minister is also trying to say, we are not going to accept homosexuality. The president already made the Gambians believe that the reason that the European Union cut funding to him is because of homosexuality. Unbelievable. So yeah, that's the president. Can you imagine the president of your country saying, I will slit the throats of any man who's trying to marry another man? Over in Ireland, let's turn our attention to Ireland. As Ireland prepares to vote on extending marriage rights to same-sex couples this May and just next week, anti-equality forces are recycling the tired and discredited argument that children would be harmed. We still say things like this. Children would be harmed if same-sex couples are allowed to marry. In a nationally televised debate this week featuring representatives from four different groups, two of them were anti-equality, two of them were pro-equality. Those opposed to equal marriage echoed the hollow fears of Anita Bryant, whose infamous Save Our Children campaign painted all gay people as sexual predators. This is a quote from Margaret Hickey of Mothers and Fathers Matter, which, oh my gosh, do I have an issue with the name of that organization, but she said this quote, "Marriage is the foundation on which the family is structured, so if you change the definition of marriage, which you are doing in a very fundamental way by taking it from a gender-based instruction to genderless institution, you are going to obviously profoundly change the constitutional understanding of parents and families." She went on to assert claims that marriage somehow would hurt children, which is a tactic that has been used for decades, and it looks pretty desperate. And as I say, week in and week out on this show, you are going to see these practices get more and more desperate as we get closer and closer to equality. This is what happens when people feel a sense of panic. This is what happens when people see their status quo, no matter how misguided or, you know, inappropriate it may be to other people, when they see their status quo being threatened, that sense of urgency will, without question, affect how they are approaching this issue, and their tactics will get more desperate. More and more desperate. Hey, let's turn our attention back to the U.S. A student who convinced Wheaton College to let him start an LGBT support group, he has been ousted as its leader after coming out of the closet himself. Let's just file this story under irony. Justin Massey started Refuge, a, quote, student-led campus support group for students who identify as non-heterosexual or are questioning their sexual identity, as he himself was coming out at Wheaton. He told this to the Orange County Register last month. It's not clear whether Massey's sexuality ever came up as he negotiated with the administration to start this group called Refuge. He said this, quote, "There were definitely some big obstacles and difficult conversations, but I think it came down to us and the administration coming together and seeing what we can affirm as Christians." The two-year-old club draws 15 to 20 regular members, but it's no longer officially led by Massey. Massey told the newspaper that not only did the school revoke his chairmanship of Refuge after he came out, but it removed him from a student government committee. Wheaton's community covenant is technically binding on all students, though it's not clear how strictly it is enforced. The covenant states that Christian scripture condemns sexual immorality, such as the use of pornography, premarital sex, adultery, homosexual behavior, and all other sexual relations outside the bounds of marriage between a man and a woman. Massey told reporters this, quote, "I was absolutely angry. It gave me shock and anxiety to feel feared by students and the administration, like my faith and loyalty were being questioned." He was hoping to lay the groundwork for a gay-straight alliance at Wheaton before graduating this month. So he does graduate this month. But yeah, Wheaton College allowing an LGBT group to exist on their campus as a safe space, but then ousting the gay member of that group. Wow. There is good news. There's more good news out there. Let's bookend. We can bookend, you know, the initial not great news with some good news. Virginia's Fairfax County School Board, which is the largest school system in the state, voted 10-1 to add a clause to its non-discrimination policy to include protections for transgender students and workers. Love this. Ryan McElveen, the school board member who sponsored the measure, said this, quote, "We are hoping this will bring a new age of respect and valuing of transgender and gender non-conforming students and employees." There you go. That's a great thing. And a congratulations to Luxembourg Prime Minister Xavier Bettel. He is openly gay and he will marry his partner this week. Luxembourg passed a law in 2014 to allow marriage equality. We love that. There are other great stories out there. One I do want to highlight real quick. There is an op-ed over in The Advocate. It's written by Bryn Tannehill. And Bryn graduated from the Naval Academy in 1997 before serving as a campaign analyst while deployed overseas. She later worked as a senior defense research scientist in private industry. She left the drilling reserves and began transitioning in 2010. Since then, she has written for OutServe, the New Civil Rights Movement, Salon, Everyday Feminism, The Good Men Project, Balearical, and The Huffington Post. And she wrote a piece called Six Ways to Not Be a Terrible Trans Ally. And it's a great piece. And I'm just going to highlight the six ways, but there's more exposition under each of the ways. So I urge you to Google Six Ways to Not Be a Terrible Trans Ally by Bryn Tannehill, Tannehill. And here are the six ways. Number one, don't support reparative therapy on transgender children. Yeah, don't do that. Number two, make at least one transgender specific issue a priority. And there are so many out there. Number three, have a basic level of competence on transgender culture. Please do that. Don't just know the L's and the G's and the B's. Know the T's. Number four, do not side with extremists. Number five, don't appear to side with transphobic people. And number six, don't call transgender people perverts and self-hating homosexuals. This is kind of the baseline, the minimal amount that you could possibly do to not be a terrible trans ally. We want you to be amazing trans allies, but here's the minimal amount you can do for, you know, not being a terrible one. It's a great piece, a great piece. And last but not least, the FDA, and everybody is writing to me about this, and I'm not going to provide too much commentary on it because I'm not sure quite what to say yet, but the Food and Drug Administration is outlining its plan to end the nation's lifetime ban on blood donations from gay and bisexual men, a 32-year-old policy that many medical groups and gay activists say is no longer justified. The FDA this week released proposed guidelines for screening blood donors at increased risk of carrying HIV. Under the proposal, the current blanket ban on donations from gay men would be replaced with a policy barring donations from men who have had sex with another man in the past year. The Obama administration previously announced this policy shift back in December. We covered it back then. If it's finalized, the new policy would put the U.S. in line with other countries that enforce a one-year deferral period on donations from sexually active gay men, including these one-year deferrals in Australia, Japan, and in the United Kingdom. Gay activists, however, continued to question whether requiring a year of celibacy from gay men amounts to a significant policy shift. The Human Rights Campaign said the FDA's plan was a step in the right direction, but that it would continue to stigmatize gay and bisexual men. This is from David Stacey, HRC's Government Affairs Director. He said this, quote, "This policy prevents men from donating life-saving blood based solely on their sexual orientation rather than actual risk to the blood supply." Just to remind you, many medical groups, including the American Medical Association, have previously said that the lifetime ban is no longer supported by science, given advances in HIV testing. In 2006, the Red Cross, the American Association of Blood Banks, and America's Blood Centers called the ban medically and scientifically unwarranted. And yet the ban persists. So now the focus is going to have to shift from the lifetime ban to, hey, what does it mean to have a one-year deferral? Again, this idea that you are engaged in some sort of activity and you're thinking to yourself, you know what? I need to articulate that I have to stop this sexual activity right this very second because I would like to donate blood in a year. So it has to be extraordinarily intentional, and I'm all for intentional altruism, but I'm also for spontaneous altruism. I'm also for, hey, you just saw a blood drive and you want to go give blood. Oh, no, wait, I've had sex in the past year. So I can't. It just doesn't make any sense. I don't know. I might write a piece about this. I might not. I'm getting a little bit tired of talking about this and feeling just so stigmatized by the FDA. I think that quote from the Human Rights Campaign is right. You just feel so marginalized and you feel dirty. The FDA makes me feel dirty. And it's gross. It's gross. So, yeah, I guess I have to now factor into my personal life if I want to give blood in a year. I don't even know what I'm doing this weekend. I can't really think about what I'm doing in a year. And then also the idea that I'm going to put this into my planner and walk backwards and inform everyone. No, I'm sorry. I couldn't. I couldn't possibly. I would like to donate blood in a year. I don't like it. I don't like it. But there it is. That's the FDA moving forward, according to some. Not so much, according to me. And that, my friends, is all the news that we have time for this week. Our huge, huge thanks to Jay Mace III. What an incredible presence. What an incredible voice. Go check out his poetry. I urge you to go to YouTube and watch his video called Josephine. It will most definitely affect you. And when was the last time you saw spoken word poetry? We got to get those voices out there even more. And of course, our thanks to you for listening. Love that you guys listen. Amazing new episodes coming up. We have tons of new episodes coming up with amazing new guests that we have never had on the show before. So we have some returning folks. We have some new folks. All excitement. Keep tuning in. Keep listening. Keep subscribing there on iTunes. There's a link right to iTunes on thisshowisogay.com, or just go to iTunes and type in "This Show Is So Gay" and you can subscribe and it will be automatically downloaded into your phone, into your tablet, into your computer every single week. You guys get out there, go use your voice the way that you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? Summer nights.